Okay. Well, round two tonight. You should once again have your Bibles open to Romans chapter 8. And before we go on to deal with the godly remedy that's given to us in verse 36, and as if you didn't have enough to do, you should have been reading over the 44th Psalm. I've told you to do that before, but if you haven't heard, familiarize yourself with the 44th Psalm, because Paul quotes that Psalm as an as it is written issue, not as a for it is written issue, but as an as it is written issue. For thy sake we are killed all the day long, we are counted as sheep for the slaughter. Before we go on to deal with that godly remedy given to us there in verse 36 and its powerful conclusion in verse 37, and nay, in all these things, we are more than conquerors. I mean, that the word more there just blows you away. It's not just that we are conquerors, and it doesn't just mean that we are really, really conquerors. We'll have to understand what it means to be more than a conqueror. We are more than conquerors through Him that loved us. Before we go on and deal with that godly remedy and deal with that powerful conclusion, we first of all have to give, I think, as I said before, deep and thoughtful consideration to each and every one of these seven things listed in the final part of the probing question in verse 35. And to be honest with you, I thought about this a lot today. I've thought about it a lot before I ever got to this point, but I'm not sure how I can get this accomplished in a Bible class. I don't mean just one Bible class. I mean in 100 Bible classes. I don't know how I can get this done. In fact, I don't think it's really possible for me to do what needs to be done. There comes a point where you have to do the work. I can't do your work for you. And that may not set well with some people. It certainly doesn't set well with the vast majority of Christians. But I just can't do that work in your heart. There comes a point, I've found this out, that there comes a point where it's almost like as we go through sonship together, it's like much of what I do slips further and further out of my hands, and it's being turned over to you. Because I have to acknowledge the fact that you're a son too. You're a daughter too. And so some of this, and I think, like I said, to be honest, I don't know how I can actually accomplish this. But, and that's really because what this requires is that you have to spend the time. You have to spend the time dealing with your own honest, probing consideration of the scope of these seven things mentioned in verse 35. Because verse 36 comes along and expects that to be done. Verse 36 comes along and expects the full effectual working of verse 35 to have taken place and to have done its job. Once that consideration has been given to every one of those seven, and you see, you perceive, I can't do this because I'm not you. The ones that give me problems and pause and trepidation and fear and all those things may not be what rings your bell, pushes your button, or whatever, causes your knees to flap against one another. Some things, some stress I've taken just as a pastor my whole life. Being alienated, that's not really a problem for me. I actually welcome it. being ostracized, how much more ostracized can we get? I mean, nobody knows what to do with us. They have this weird idea that the Bible should be rightly divided and that Paul's epistles are the ones we're supposed to, that contain our information, and they call us things like ultra-dispensationalists or hyper. Nobody likes to be called hyper anything. He's hyper. You know, all kinds of things like this. Then to make matters worse, even among the grace camp, the grace believers who do rightly divide the word of truth, we don't follow most of their teaching as well. Some of the oddities that go along with that are things that, for instance, and you may not even be aware of it, but there's a very strong pressure among many grace folks to embrace this idea that only in this dispensation of grace are you saved by grace through faith. And that no one at any other time was saved by grace through faith. But they were saved by grace plus some modicum of works. And they could lose their salvation. And only in this dispensation do you have the assurance of your eternal security. So there's a lot of that even in the grace camp. And so we're divided off from them. And then there's the ones who see, well, Paul's writings go from milk to meat, but this whole sonship thing, that's just the teaching of a man, and they're making way too much out of it. So we're then ostracized even more than that. I think if it goes another step beyond that, we're going to be wearing sheets in a commune somewhere. I mean, it's just, we can't, you know, it just seems like less and less people really want this thing. So I've come to live with that. That's comfortable now. I've become comfortable with it. It's just the way things are. So I'm using it as an illustration to say that this is an area where you're going to have to make evaluations based on your own life, your own makeup, your own character, and who you are. So I'm saying that as a caveat to going through these things, because it's just one of those areas where I'm going to have to step back and hand it over to you and allow you to do that for yourself. And therefore, we do need to say something about each one of these, something that hopefully will awaken the reality of it in your heart. Then you can take it and think about it and roll these over. You can say with assurance or with honesty that you're ready for the godly remedy, that you face these things, and they've done their job to make you aware. Well, you know, where I sit right now, I'm not wanting that to happen, and I could have a real problem here. And we may talk about this a little more, but for tonight, I just want to get these kind of out in front of you and give a little bit of consideration to each one in their successive order. So therefore, you're going to have to give yourself some time, and you're going to have to yourself give thoughtful consideration to tribulation. There's a akin type word that comes from that whenever I see tribulation, it's one of the first things that pops into my mind, and that's trouble. When you talk about tribulation, you got trouble. So tribulation is basically that which can cause you trouble. And you have to put yourself in a frame of mind in which you begin to think about being in a position now, as I said at the break, for no other reason than your sonship status and your sonship life and living out of its aims and its goals and its objectives, you find yourself in a position where you begin experiencing trouble. By the way, don't start thinking past. Like, let's see, where has that happened? This hasn't happened. None of these things have happened to you yet. Not one of them. They won't until you get past Romans 12:3. These things aren't even going to begin to happen right now. So don't start thinking, well, I can't think of that happening. You're not. I want you to put yourself in a frame of mind in which, because you have reached out to and strived to get to a particular aim, getting from point A to point B, I have, in the process of doing that, in my sonship education, for no other reason than that, I find myself in a position of experiencing some trouble, some misery, and difficulties. And here's something that could fall under that tribulation: embarrassment and offenses, being offended. And for no other reason than putting your sonship life into practice. And again, all I can do is generalize these, but you need to think about the kind of trouble that you could conceivably be in as you're trying to reach a goal in your sonship life that for no other reason than that policy of evil has thrown that roadblock in my way. That adversary has at his disposal the means to bring trouble into my life, where you would be able to say, you know, if I wasn't going that way, I wouldn't have this trouble. You ever turn down a road I did once in the wintertime, taking my dear wife home when we were just dating, and my dad told me, don't go down that road. It's a shortcut, but it had snowed about 8 inches during the basketball game, and it was just a mess. And I saw a couple cars going down that way, and I turned down that road, and I looked at Cindy. God is my witness. She's my witness. I looked her right in the eye, and I said, if Dad could only see me now. And before I could finish the word now, I had hit a snowdrift and went directly into the ditch, threw every belt off my car, and I thought I had broken the block, and it took a farmer who knew my father very well to get his tractor and pull me out of there. I had to give Cindy and her sister to someone else to take home. I learned my lesson. But sometimes you're going to, traveling down a road and you realize, you know, I wouldn't have this trouble if I was on this other road. That's the kind of, that I'm not talking about any kind of tribulation. I'm talking about tribulation for no other reason than you're traveling that road. If I just got off that road and I could do it today, this would stop. That's the kind of things we're faced with here. Distress. Even in the English language, I love just the way these words are spelled and the way you have to say them. Distress. It sounds horrible. It is horrible. When you're feeling, usually when you talk about distress, you're talking about some form of pressure. And you're feeling direct pressure being applied to you, and that pressure is being applied to you to prevent you from something. To prevent you applying the aims and the goals and the objectives of your sonship life. That's one of the great shades of meaning of the word distress. That it's not just pressure, but it's pressure that's designed to prevent you from reaching a goal. The pressure to hide it from view, or to the pressure to opt out of it and opt for some other competing form of wisdom or competing form of godliness. This almost comes to the point where you start to begin having the thought roll around in your mind and you say, you know, things aren't so bad right now, but if I keep on going down this road, it's going to really get bad. Even that can be a chink where the adversary can get a toehold of pressuring you. You know, you might want to think about altering your course. After all, what did you learn back there in the Proverbs? There's many paths. There's competing paths that you could talk about Jesus. You could win, you know, witness to people and do this and do that and have a great time doing it. You don't need to travel this path. You don't need to. That objective down there. This is the kind of trash talk that you'll hear. That objective down there is going to get you nothing but trouble. Yeah. Is it the coffee pot? Kind of smells like a burning diaper. Okay. You're sure we're okay? Okay. Because I smell it now.
Yes.
Do we have a little grill back there? I don't know. Are we starting hot dogs and sausage balls? Well, as she goes and checks up. But that, do you see what I'm after? Where some pressure would come along and say, if you keep going down, you're going to be in all manner of trouble. You're going to have all kinds of problems. And so you start realizing there are other. You know, if any time somebody gets around a Christian who's quote-unquote on fire, no pun intended, but, you know, he's really on fire, she's really on fire, the woods are full. I mean, they come out of the woods at you. Oh, you got to come to our church. You got to do this. Have you read this book? Have you read this pamphlet? Have you heard this guy? Here's this tape. Here's this CD. Here's this DVD. They come out, they come at you like, you know, like you're asking to buy the ShamWow or something. You know, they're just all over you. You let it out of the bag that you are a very dedicated believer in Jesus Christ. You're going to have people coming out of the woods trying to convince you that that what you're involved in is getting you nowhere. You go to some little tiny church, it's probably a cult, and it's not growing, it's not got a lot of money, it doesn't have this, it doesn't have that, it doesn't have a choir, it doesn't have an organ, it doesn't, you know, on and on and on and on. You got to do this where God is really moving. You know, I'm not even sure that's exactly a biblical expression. Maybe it's in there somewhere. But I always, when I hear that, I always think, what, was he constipated? I'm serious. Because, well, God had a great movement here. Really? I don't know if I want to be a part of that. But you're going to have all kinds of competing forms of godliness, but they are godliness that is, as the Scripture says, denies the power thereof. And denying the power thereof, denying the doctrine of the sonship life, the curriculum, as being the only acceptable, I mean only acceptable form of godliness that God your Father will accept and be pleased with. Again, it's amazing. You can almost, not quite, but almost, find Christians agreeing that justification is by grace through faith, and then all bets are off, Katie, bar the door. As to what comes after that. It's just a hodgepodge of, hey, stick your finger in the wind and anything that blows, grab it. They don't realize that God is just as adamant about sanctification as he is about justification. There's only one way he'll accept and be pleased with. And so there's an enormous pressure when you start talking that way. There's enormous pressure because of the pressure that would come along, and in distress, something's going to come along there, and somebody's going to either say something or do something that's going to hit a nerve in your human spirit. That's again why I say I can't get any more detailed than that, because for you, it wouldn't be hitting a nerve at all. You got Novocaine there. But for me, it's hit a nerve, and it begins to interfere. Distress always attacks the calmness of your mind, and it begins to interfere with your mind of calmness and interfere with your assurance and conviction, and actually starts to go after not only the love of Christ but that hope that you had. Because absolute confidence bespeaks, I like that word, of a settled mind. You're fully settled on this. And distress will try to unnerve you, hit a nerve, and interfere with calm, sure, and hope, and create in you a heart of unsettledness of your mind and the feeling of helplessness and helpless suffering, almost like, here I am. It's like being out, I'm in the middle of the ocean, I'm suffering, and nothing or no one seems to care. And what's the next step after that? Panic. I once heard somebody say, I don't know if it's true or not, but I always thought about it and thought there was at least some truth to it. Panic is what happens when you run out of information. Kind of like the guy who's trying to fly the plane by the book, and all of a sudden the last two pages are ripped out of it. Now we can panic. But you learn something in sonship establishment. You learn something that you'll never be at a point where he's not going to do what? Freely give you all things. Even at that point, I will have what I need. The curriculum has it in it. But that's what distress can do. It can cause panic and this helpless feeling. Where that would normally set in is in that area of distress. And you need to give thoughtful consideration to persecution. I think that's the one that everybody probably knows pretty much what that's about. Whereby, again, as you go on, I'm not talking about being persecuted just because you've been witnessing for Jesus. I'm talking about persecution. Again, don't relegate terms to only one meaning or one context. This is sonship persecution, whereby as you go on to attain more of the aims and the goals and the objectives, allow to cross through your mind at some point in this, think about that table of contents and think about going through the things we said in level 1 and level 2 and level 3 of sonship life. And think about where persecution would become a real issue as you attain the aims, goals, and objectives of living out your sonship life. You go from distress to persecution. What you've done is you've gone from what's in your mind to now what goes on in your physical life. As you begin to experience the actual infliction of physical pain and punishment, injury, a whole host of things you could talk about, or the issue of being, even in persecution, the issue of being pursued. Now somebody's after you. It's one thing just to have people tell you you're a moron at Christmas, Easter, and Thanksgiving when you get around the family. But now they're coming after you. They're hunting you down. And you've got this actual pursuing and hunting down and being driven out of things. And I mean this seriously. You could be driven out of your job. You could be driven out of your... You could be driven out of any relationship you can think of, humanly speaking. Husband, wife, husband, children, blah, blah, blah. They could just disown you. Watch out, parents. You can also get sued by your kids today, you know. Anyway, I'm trying to get across to you that the kind of physical danger that's involved in persecution, because there's physical injury in view, and the issue of being hunted down, driven out of your home, your town, your country, where for the first time you find yourself having to think that real physical harm could happen to you. That could happen. Where someone is actually trying to hunt you down, harass you, injure you, and maybe even kill you for no other reason than putting your sonship life into practice and attaining that goal, aim, or objective that you're after. And famine, where the effects of living out your sonship life brings the separation tactics of the policy of evil to bear upon the necessities of life. And where you begin to experience going in want of food and proper nutrition. Some of you have probably already experienced, not because of your sonship life, but you've got something you can hang a hook on here in your mind, where maybe some of you have been from a background where at some point in your life you didn't know where your next meal was coming from. I know it may not look like it, but I've been in that position. And as you can see, God has always provided. But that's a reality. Where you begin to experience going in want of food and proper nutrition, as well as the general issue of being in a position of poverty. Famine bespeaks poverty. You've lost something by this point. And you're in want of the basic provisions in life, a condition that greatly, by the way, that greatly alters how you normally live. And by its very nature, famine has that biblical overtone to it, and rightfully so, as being always thought of as evil, connected with it, and some evil having come upon you, that you're in a position of famine, and you now think about something you've never thought about before. I don't know where my next meal is coming from. nakedness. By the way, you notice how after you get to the persecution issue, the ones that come after that, you notice how the policy of evil goes right after all of those things that we consider social virtues and your social status and standing? It's a powerful thing. Even among every class, it's powerful. Because there's wealthy, then there's the poor wealthy. I may be poor, but I'm of the wealthiest on my block of poor people. That is a powerful issue, that social status, because it's directly connected to something within our flesh that we desire greatly by nature. And I'm not talking about by divine nature. I'm talking about by human, sinful, Adamic nature. And that is to be pleasing in the eyes of men. And when I look on this and I see the persecution and what happens after that, I see that adversary going right after all those social status symbols and ruining them in the eyes of men. Ruining your status in the view of even other Christians. It's amazing, too. I almost brought this quote in. It's not my quote, and I can't quote it exact, but it's the idea. The idea today is that only if you sit on a panel on some TV show with a Muslim, with some Hindu, a Buddhist, and some spiritualist, that if you the only Christian virtue that can even be comprehended by the people who put those things on is that you as a Christian will humbly take the error of other people's ways and say nothing about it. That is a virtue in the eyes of the media. That the evil, horrible Christian is the one who would say that Muslim is going to go to hell if he dies today believing what he believes. I'm not trying to wrest him out of it. I'm not trying to force him to believe anything. He's free. But the Word of God says that Jesus Christ is the only way. And somebody should look Larry King in the eye and tell him he is going to go to hell when he dies, instead of pussyfooting around about it. But you see, the pressure to not look like a lunatic is enormous. Now, the nakedness issue. I just think it's fascinating how this thing ruins your status in the eyes of men. You find yourself in actual want of proper clothing. I know there's many ways to take nakedness. There's even a spiritual way that many people take it, but I don't find that here. I'm going to stick with just the general description of what they mean in general. You're unable to buy, or, you know, if you're naked, you don't even have the means to buy anything. You can't even supply. I mean, you're living off the land now. You know, you're going back to fig leaves. But you're actually reduced to a point of being in want of proper clothing, destitute, unable to buy or provide for your own attire. Reduced to being to barren poverty and stripped of all of the basic essential material possessions, to the point where even being properly clothed becomes a real problem. To be able to just be able to be presentable and go out in public becomes a problem. And give thoughtful consideration to peril. Peril, that when you go to live out those aims, goals, and objectives of your sonship life, it can bring a situation and separation tactics from the policy of evil to bear upon you to the point where you find yourself in a position of imminent danger. When you're in peril, you're in imminent, immediate danger. Use the word peril outside of that context. Whenever it's a perilous situation, you're in immediate danger of losing, in fact, of losing everything you have, danger of losing everything and everyone around you. The real and present danger of even the loss of your life. Peril also has, in fact, its strongest connotation is that you're in danger of dying. By the way, peril is always immediate and personal and life-threatening. It's always those three things. It's personal, immediate, and life-threatening. And you find yourself just surrounded by danger. You're in Indian Territory all the time. By the way, when I think about peril, just out of curiosity, did a verse cross your mind, even though you don't know the address of it? What one? Well, I don't want to turn to it because I don't want to get into the context and all that surrounds it. But when I think of peril, and it does have a parallel application here, but I often recall what the Apostle Paul said over in 2 Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians 11:26. He's giving a list of things that he's experienced and gone through. And in one verse there he says, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren. You get the idea that he's in peril? Paul faced all of these in spades, so to speak. And I think of him when I think of these. I think of how his life was so prosperous and so, not only money-wise, he would be able to have all the money he couldn't spend all the money he would have. He was in the largest, most lucrative extortion system that man has ever produced. They've got nothing on the mafia. I mean, the mafia has nothing on the Pharisees. It's the other way around. The mafia has nothing on the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the original super extorters. And again, they were the ones who could send you to hell and make you feel good to go. They could extort you and make you feel like you were doing God the biggest favor in keeping the law and doing it. If you didn't, they'd make up part of the law and then be able to get the money out of you. They'd sell stuff in the temple. Gee, does that go on in churches? Yeah, it's called fundraising. But it goes on. Sure it does. Paul was the leading up and coming genius, rising star in that whole thing. He was going to be known all over the world. He was going to have worldwide fame, worldwide wealth, worldwide publicity, and everything that went along with it. And he said, I took all of that, and that is a big pile of manure. That's a pile of dung. And I have lost all things for the cause of Christ. And when you start thinking about this, go over and read some things in Philippians and start realizing, yeah, Paul's had to go under these kinds of things, and he has become a more than conqueror in all of them. And finally, you consider the one that we all want to stay away from, the sword. What can you say about it? It's the most extreme separation tactic of all, whereby under proper circumstances in your sonship life, the satanic policy of evil can take your physical life. And you find Paul dealing with that, with his own life. It's there in the book of Philippians. Most people have no idea what he's talking about. Because outside of a sonship frame of mind, you're just going to think he's a little bit goofy. Because he's talking about, I don't know whether I've apprehended or not apprehended, or to go or what. And he talks about, it sounds like he's waffling all over the place. You see that through the eyeglasses of sonship education. And that is as clear as a bell, of what he's thinking. And that one should hit you like an anvil. When you're sitting here with all this gung-ho enthusiasm and your father says, you know, son, this can get dicey, this can get dangerous, and you could die doing this. That enemy that you have has at his disposal to take your life under certain circumstances. It could actually happen. And that's to hit you like a ton of bricks, that the living out of just the desire, the living out of the aims and the goals and the objectives of my sonship life can get this dangerous? I could die for this? I could die because of this? Yeah. This is the extreme degree of resistance and opposition that you're going to have to face from an adversary and his policy of evil. That's the degree he's willing to go. That's why you're going to have that strong conviction to be able to realize that even in that situation, with that as my prospect, I know it's going to work together for good. Not because of some blind, unintelligent quoting of a memory verse, but because of the dramatic, effectual working of my sonship establishment, plus the doctrine when I would be at that point that allows to connect and mate with that and produce in me being able to use even the sword of my adversary to not just be victorious, but to propel me to a greater conquering than if it had not happened at all. And as I said before, it's funny that it seems there's really only two individuals that take this list seriously. That take sonship education seriously oftentimes, present company excepted. And as I said, God and Satan. They take it that, and rare if ever, that even one single Christian on planet Earth take sonship edification and sonship establishment or sonship education and edification that seriously. To most Christians, it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter near as much as the next youth program. It doesn't matter near as much as that. And that means that what they do take seriously, you ever think of this? What they do take seriously, God never takes seriously. It's not going to have one thing to do with their reward and decoration at the judgment seat of Christ. They're going to stand up there and dance around and say, look at this. And God says, all right, let's try it. Next. Didn't have anything. That didn't matter to me. I wasn't concerned about any of that stuff that you spent all that money and time doing. My concern is educating sons to run my business, and you can't run it. Sorry. And by the way, Satan doesn't take what they're doing seriously either. He's not after them because they got that big budget. He's not trying to make their rockers fall off when they're rocking for Jesus. Or rain when they have their youth outing. It wasn't the devil that did that. That was the weather. He's not concerned with the kiddies who are on the wading into the pool. He's concerned with the ones who are striking out and crying, Abba, Father, and becoming a real threat to the only vestige he's got left to be able to complete the success of his initial plan of evil to possess this earth and the heavenly places. And that's you. Well, we'll stop right there for tonight, but you do have to take these home with you and think about them, thoughtfully consider them. Don't look at it as a discouraging thing at all, because we've got verse 36 and verse 37 to tell us that it's not to be discouraging. But it does strip out all that human bravado. You're not facing your sonship life. If you get out of verse 37 properly, you're not facing your sonship life with some false courage. You've soberly been confronted with what you're going to have to face. And that means you are fully, fully trusting implicitly in your Father and in His curriculum. And you're not trying to face this with some stoic, stiff upper lip or some screwed up courage. I mean, where you screw your courage up to face something, but that your Father's going to produce in you that and provide for you so that all those things you are more than a conqueror in. Well, we'll stop right there and see where we go from here. All right.